It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly segment on Congress with a congressional reporter. We'll learn about the spending bill on its way through Congress and discuss other news from the nation's capital.
But first, we're talking about enrollment in the new healthcare exchanges here in Wisconsin.
This week, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services released state-by-state data on Obamacare enrollment, and Wisconsin tied for the state with the most elderly adults enrolled in the healthcare exchanges.
Here to break down the data for us is Guy Bolton, a reporter who covers the business of healthcare and health policy for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Guy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So it sounds like the numbers enrolling in the Affordable Care Act, that has gone up. Tell us the change we've seen.
There was a sharp increase in enrollment in December, as you would expect, since the marketplaces or exchanges were essentially inoperable in October and much of November. They had so far a total of 40,752 people through, I believe, December 28th have signed up for plans on the marketplaces.
Does that mean Wisconsin is on its way to meeting its goal for enrollment?
That I don't know. We've lost essentially 2 months. December, you saw a surge or jump in enrollment. But the next 3 months is anybody's guess.
Go ahead.
No, there's going to be a lot of work for people who are helping people sign up for coverage between now and March 31st, the deadline.
Do you know what we can attribute the jump in people signing up to? Do you think it's just that the website is working better? Is it a simple matter of time?
My guess would be that it's the website was working. I mean, the launch of the Affordable Care Act websites was marketplaces was a disaster. There's just no getting around that. And supporters would acknowledge that, as would opponents.
So one of the biggest headlines to come out of these numbers is that Wisconsin tied with West Virginia as the state with the highest number of older adults enrolled in exchanges. What do you make of that news?
What I have been told, and we will have a story this weekend on this, is the figures were the enrollment among people who were young and presumably healthy were certainly lower than expected, but nothing that was shocking. In Wisconsin, the real test will be what happens in the next few months. What people say is that people who are younger are more likely to come in towards the March 31st deadline. And the folks that I've interviewed have said that, it's really just too early to gauge what this means or could mean.
So more older adults enrolled right now, fewer younger people. What is the age range for older adults that we're talking about?
There was about 45% of the people who have enrolled in plans sold on the marketplaces were between the ages of 55 and 64 in Wisconsin. People who are 26 to 34, it was 12%. For people who are 18 to 25, it was 7%. A brief that Kaiser Family Foundation put out estimated that about 40% of the population would be in the, say, 18 to 35 age group, and that ideally, that's the proportion of people you would want in the so-called risk pools for these health plans.
So as you said yourself, you think that younger people may likely come in closer to that March 31st deadline. In the meantime, though, are there concerns that because there are so many more older people enrolled in the Affordable Care Act that it's going to drive the prices up?
you know, certainly there are concerns. I mean, and certainly opponents have jumped on this and warned of what is known as a death spiral in the insurance industry. The experience in Massachusetts was younger people came in later. How many young people will come in the first year is anybody's guess. But the conventional wisdom held that in the first year of the Affordable Care Act, there would be less younger people coming into the marketplaces. The you know, what it means going forward is kind of a different story. You know, there is general agreement, though, that you do need young and healthy people to offset the costs of people who are older and more likely to be sicker. That's the way insurance works.
Now, there are some Obamacare advocates who are saying that this is news that should alert state leaders that they need to put more effort into reaching out to young people, marketing to young people, raising awareness about the Affordable Care Act. Do you think that's going to happen?
Yes, I don't know. But, you know, they certainly don't have a lot of time.
So what do you think will happen if those numbers don't roll in?
The people I've interviewed for the story that we'll have this weekend have said it is just too early to tell. I mean, there are people certainly who are predicting that this will lead to sharp increases in 2015 and future years. But the folks I have spoken to have said that, you know, it is just too early to tell. And there are a variety of factors that go into rates. Also, what is hard to gauge is actuaries tend to be conservative, and it is reasonable to assume that to some degree they built into the rates the widespread expectation that fewer young people would come into these plans in the first year.
So that may be built in.
Could be built in, and there are other factors. In 2015, the exchanges, next year, the exchanges will be, presumably, the exchanges will be working and have a better design. The penalty for not having coverage increases next year and in 2016. This year, it is just 1% of your income or a minimum of $95. By 2016, it is 2.5% of your income. And, you know, when it gets up to 2.5%, you know, for people may feel like, well, I'm not, instead of paying the penalty and getting nothing, I'll get health insurance.
And do you think there is a reason that you could point to right now that young people haven't signed out? Is it simple procrastination, or is it more that 1% isn't enough, like you were just talking about?
That would just be conjecture on my part. I mean, certainly, you know, with all the stories about the exchange not working, you would think why mess with this? There have been, you know, various surveys done, and they conflict. But there seems, you know, some surveys have suggested that there young people do have a value for health insurance, and that, you know, they will eventually come in into the marketplace and buy health plans.
Well, Guy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Guy Bolton, a reporter who covers the business of healthcare and health policy for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Up next, we'll check in on the latest news from Congress, including the spending bill on its way through the national legislature.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Last week, we began our new series covering the inner workings of the United States Congress, one of the least liked in American history, according to recent polls.
Last Wednesday, we talked about the prospects for extending the federal unemployment benefits that expired in December. We'll get an update on where those stand today. And also this week, Congress appears to have agreed on an appropriations bill that would keep the government open through September.
If the bill passes, it would be the first of its kind since 2011. We're joined now by USA Today Congress and Politics editor Paul Singer. He blogs at How Government Works and tweets from @SingerNews. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much. How are you doing?
Great. Well, before we get to that appropriations bill, Democratic Representative Jim Moran from Virginia announced today he's not going to seek re-election. He's been in Congress a long time. He's 68. Is there anything more to this than a congressman deciding, hey, time to pack it in?
Well, not in the individual context, no. I think he's just a congressman packing it in. But what's interesting, if you look at the trend over the past few weeks, there's been a half dozen members in the same sort of tranche as Moran. That is, people who are more or less centrist, have been in Congress a while, and are leaving and retiring now because they just don't want to do it anymore. I am seeing this as like the hollowing out of the middle of the Congress. Many of these folks, you know, Moran's district is a Democratic district and it'll stay a Democratic district, but many of these folks are in sort of swing districts. If they were conservative Democrats, those seats are going to go to Republicans. If they were moderate Republicans, those seats are probably going to go to Democrats. But you'll just see, it's interesting to see that we've now got about a half dozen or so retirements of people who are considered long-serving, respected moderates.
Well, and that, between that and primary challenges within parties targeting relative moderates, are there going to be any moderates left, at least worthy of the term moderate, in the next few years?
I'm not sure there's much money in it. Honestly, you know, being a moderate in the U.S. Congress is kind of a lonely place to hang out. We've watched the demise of several fairly significant caucuses that were built on these sort of centrist principles. They've just sort of all drained out.
Now, you know, maybe if that keeps happening, it's going to be hard for Congress to get anything done. I know that's crazy science fiction talk, but is it going to make it even harder to find compromise?
Yeah. I mean, there's not a lot of upside to these guys to compromising on a lot of these issues. And so what you end up seeing is they don't pass a lot of bills. And they frequently don't work together on stuff. Now, there obviously are issues where you do see compromise. Not to make too graphic a segue, but we're moving on right now. There is an appropriations bill moving on the House floor, and it's going to pass with large bipartisan support because the alternative is so catastrophically bad that nobody wants to vote against it.
But the alternative has been catastrophically bad before, and people still voted against it. Why is it different now?
Because they were once bitten, twice shy. I mean, at this point, the Republicans were really opposed to the size of the spending bills and attempted to demand cuts in exchange for raising the debt ceiling back in the fall, and we got the government shutdown, and that did not work out well for them. The party really took a hit. And I think it was very, very clear from all the leadership on the Republican side they did not want that to happen again. So over Christmas, when it was announced that we've come to an agreement, bipartisan agreement, on sort of a budget deal for 2 years that just sets the levels of overall spending, at that point it was clear that the fight was going to be over. And so what they're now doing is passing a bill that nobody's read. I mean, this thing is 1,500 pages long. It was introduced 3 days ago. It's being passed now. We'll find out what's in it in a couple of weeks.
Ordinarily, when this kind of bill comes along, I would expect to see another 1,500 pages of amendments. Are we seeing any amendment process on this?
No.
None at all?
That's how they get the thing passed. That's the beauty of this thing, Rob, is if nobody reads it and no one's allowed to amend it, how can you vote no? And that's how they're handling this. They're just going to march it through. In fact, you know, the other thing to keep in mind, none of this is traditional, right? I mean, normally you would have a bill that funds the EPA and the Veterans Administration. You'd have a bill that funds the Justice Department. And there's 12 different appropriations bills, and they go through the committees, and they spent 6 months doing this. This thing, they took all those bills, mashed them into one giant bill, wrote it over the past couple of months with only three people involved, and nobody's read it, and now they're passing it in 3 days.
And I've seen some commentary that, hey, in those 1,500 pages, there are a lot of little things targeting specific states, districts, and regions, what we used to call maybe pork or that kind of thing. Is that part of why some people are ready to vote for this thing without making too big a muss about it?
Yeah, I suspect. Yeah. I mean, there are what we call sweeteners. You call them pork. We call them sweeteners. I mean,
like sweet pork and a barbecue sauce.
Part of the way they do these things is they sit down and decide what can we put in this bill that's going to make it palatable to people to vote for, and everyone has to be able to go back to their district and say, hey, we did something useful, and you know there's winners and losers. I mean, the Pentagon gets a lot of money in here, and Joe Biden loses because they're capping his salary and they're cutting a high-speed rail, which he was a big fan of. So, you know, I mean, there's a bunch of provisions in here for everybody to find something they will like. That's how you get people to say, well, okay, I'll close my eyes, hold my nose, and vote for it.
Speaking of closed eyes, light bulbs were one of the things I saw in this. The enforcement of the ban on the old-fashioned light bulbs.
I hate this story.
Why?
Because it's not exactly what it says it is. I
mean, okay.
There are new energy efficiency rules that the Energy Department has put into effect, by the way, which were required by law some years ago. And it's energy efficiency for a whole bunch of stuff, including light bulbs. Well, the light bulb ones, the way to meet the new standards is with a compact fluorescent bulb. It's not the only way to meet the standards. I mean, in theory, you could invent an incandescent bulb that would meet the standard, but no one's really thought they're going to. And the industry's not going that way anyway. The industry is building these things, these LED bulbs and other sort of high-tech bulbs anyhow. So what this does is removes enforcement of the rules. That is, removes funding for the enforcement of the rules. Okay, well, and keep in mind, we haven't banned, there's no ban on incandescent bulbs anyway, and they're also, the efficiency rules exempt stuff like appliance bulbs, your refrigerator bulb, things like that. So it's much more subtle than the way it is described. The way it is described is the army is going to come march over to your house and unscrew all your light bulbs and leave you in the dark. And it's just not true. But, yeah, you know, it's hard to, you know, the details. The people get tired of the details.
Well, here's another one that's been in the news a lot, and people are kind of cherry-picking details, it seems like. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates's memoir, Duty, came out. People have, depending on which side you're on, picked out criticisms of the Obama administration, praise of it, same with the Bush administration. What did he have to say about Congress, though?
Yeah, you know, the funny thing is that he had nice and bad things to say about everybody except Congress. And Congress, he said, basically, these people are horrible. Yeah, I mean, there's a line in there, I don't have it in front of me, but it was something along the lines of, sitting in front of Congress at a hearing, I wanted to get up out of my chair and throw up. You know, how could I be treated this way by these people who are stupid, self-serving, disinterested in the public good, preening, uninformed? I mean, he just like goes on and on and on. It is clear he viewed the U.S. Congress as just a pool of swine, and he didn't understand why he had to spend so much time dealing with these people who really didn't care about anything except scoring political points. It's a fairly remarkable blast.
Is that, do you think there's something to what he's saying, or is this just maybe any cabinet official who has to endure a congressional subcommittee hearing every couple of weeks or however often is going to feel a natural resentment there?
I think there's some of that. But I mean, I also think that obviously, you know, when we talk about this around the water cooler, that because the tone of Congress has changed so much and because there's so much less interest in legislating and more interest in scoring political points, I think you might see Gates's criticism as more a sign of the times and than it was, you know, 10 years ago. 10 years ago, I suspect what somebody like that would have said, or maybe 20 years ago would have said, is, man, those guys are a nuisance, but they're sometimes doing good work. Now, this guy is saying, they're all stupid. I can't stand them.
Wow. Well, here's some more news about Congress before we let you go. OpenSecrets.org published a study over the last week saying that for the first time in its history, the majority of Congress are millionaires. Money in politics isn't a new issue. Is this a surprising new bit of news?
No. And it's not a surprising bit of news. In fact, I'll tell you, it also understates the case. Those estimates are based on the financial disclosure forms that members of Congress file, which allow them to leave out vast amounts of assets, leave out or understate vast amounts of assets. So my suspicion is that if you had true assets reported in these things, you'd find that number closer to three-quarters to two-thirds, you know, two-thirds to three-quarters of Congress are millionaires. If you include stuff like, well, they own a house, right? That adds up already. You know, the fact of the matter is that if you are not a wealthy person, it's going to be hard for you to take, 6 months off to run for Congress and ask people to donate money and go to all the events and shake hands. And both parties are trying to recruit rich people to run for Congress, because it's easier to fund your campaign by yourself rather than asking people for money.
Right. That's a dream candidate. You can pay for your own campaign. We can put our money somewhere else.
Yeah, we call them self-funders. I mean, that's the whole point. You know, people still raise money because that's how you show support, right? You want to be able to show that people do support you. But yeah, having a lot of leisure time and a lot of money at your disposal makes it a lot easier to run for Congress, particularly in the modern era. So no, I'm not surprised at all to see, you know, the lion's share of Congress. They're wealthy people. I mean, they just are wealthy people. They're the only people who can afford to keep two houses, right? You got to go back and forth between Washington and your district. It's just not, by and large, it is not a job for somebody who doesn't have money.
We'll leave it there. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot. Good talking to you, Rob.
That's Paul Singer. He's politics and Congress editor at USA Today. He joins us each Wednesday at this time.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll take a look at what a world without carnivores would look like.
Then we'll hear about one man's year-long experience using Google Glass.
And a new study suggests that reality shows about teen pregnancy may actually be helping to decrease the number of teens that are getting pregnant.
That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.
Still to come today, positive thinking is a cornerstone of American culture, and we'll hear how it's affected modern society. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around, more to come here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, a federal appeals court ruled yesterday that internet service providers are not required to maintain neutrality when it comes to content on the web. We'll find out what exactly that means for internet users.
First, Americans tend to be known around the world for our positive thinking.
We are the place, after all, where Oprah gained millions of viewers with her encouragement to be your best self, and bookstores are filled with self-help advice.
Even political messages like, yes, we can, enforce the idea that anything we put our minds to is possible.
But how do we get to be a nation of positive thinkers? Mitch Horowitz tries to answer that question in his new book. It's called One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life. Mitch, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
How important do you think positive thinking is to American culture today?
It's really central to American culture. If it wasn't for the positive thinking movement, however we come down on it, we wouldn't feel like ourselves. You know, some of the best-known expressions in American life derive from positive thinking, whether it's yes, we can, or just do it, be all you can be, nothing is impossible. We talk in these terms, and without the positive thinking movement, our culture would look and sound very different.
Where did that come from in our history?
It really started in the mid-19th century in New England with a movement called the Mental Healing Movement or the Mind Cure Movement. American medicine was in terrible condition for much of the 19th century. In fact, our medicine lagged behind the medical sciences in Europe. It was probably the one consistent area where development in the U.S. lagged behind Europe. And people were desperate for alternatives, so they began to look to prayer therapy and autosuggestion and what would later come to be known as hypnotism and try to find ways of healing themselves. And many thousands of people decided that it worked and sought to use the mind as an agency to improve other areas of life, like career and finance and relationships.
And where did it go from there in terms of, you know, the medical claims? In general, you know, Americans, we are positive. Sometimes we're a skeptical lot, and we like there to be proof. Is there proof in the pudding that positive thinking works?
Well, most of the proof from that time was testimonial and anecdotal. It was interesting. You know, there were people who reported chores by using mental cure methods, and there were people who were struck by terrible tragedy by not seeking out standard medical care. It's just that standard medical care at the time was so poor, it was difficult proving whether it would have done any good, you know, had it been sought out, rather than using Christian Science methods, which was a religion that came out of the mental healing movement, or other forms of what was then known as mind cure. By the late 19th century, particularly with the opening of Johns Hopkins University Medical School, medicine got a lot better in this country, and by the 1890s, people weren't as desperate. There wasn't the same need to seek out alternative cures, although there were lots of them. Homeopathy, botanical remedies, and other things grew out of that era. But the country was changing, and the economy was really growing, and people were very eager and anxious to join the growing economy. And some of the people in the mental healing movement at that time, late 1880s, early 1890s, began to pioneer what later became known as the prosperity gospel, in which you would think and grow rich, as the expression goes.
Moving ahead a little bit, when I hear the phrase positive thinking, I think of The Power of Positive Thinking by Reverend Norman Vincent Peale. Mm-hmm. And as I understand it, I wasn't around when it came out, but this is a book that was all over the place in, what was it, the early 50s, 1950s?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You really can't exaggerate that book's impact. When that book came out in 1952, it became the best-selling book that had ever been published in America, with the exception of the Bible. I mean, it was a book that you would just find in every household. It's still quite popular today. And the author, Norman Vincent Peale, was a Methodist minister who grew up in Ohio. And during the Great Depression, he was placed in charge of a congregation on Manhattan's east side, a Dutch Reformed congregation. And Peale was politically and culturally a very conservative guy, but religiously, he was a great experimenter. And he was willing to look into all kinds of different methods, many of which had to do with positive thinking metaphysics. There were movements that ranged from Christian Science to New Thought, which was really the movement that the mental cure had morphed into. And Peale just experimented and looked everywhere. He was had an early interest in the thought of the psychologist Carl Jung. He was interested in the ideas of William James and the Transcendentalists. And Peale came to feel that the positive thinking thesis, which is that our thoughts are causative, could be supported by statements in Scripture. And so he proceeded to write The Power of Positive Thinking, and he made positive thinking into a household term.
Is there something that smacks of first world privilege about positive thinking at all, that you actually have the time to read these books and devote your time to thinking positively instead of, you know, working hard to earn money and put food on the table?
Yes, and that's a real flaw of the positive thinking movement. I think there has been value in this movement, but it became an American movement because ours for many generations was an expanding country, an expanding economy, and even though there were great differences and inequities and imbalances in wealth, we at least could have the ideal that the individual could raise him or herself up. And Americans believed in that, wanted to believe in that. And the fact is, you know, today you will find a positive thinking movement in America that touches every corner of the nation. And obviously, you're not going to find the same thing on other continents or in other nations where there's a great deal of poverty, where people are locked in a daily struggle to survive. To some extent, ours is a movement of geography, and I encourage people in the positive thinking movement to be cognizant of things like that, because positive thinking in America grew up hand in hand, partly because of the circumstances of America as a nation.
You raise some concerns throughout the book with the way the positive thinking movement has evolved, affected people. But by and large, it seems, looking at your book, like you're sympathetic to it. What's the positive side of positive thinking as you see it?
I am sympathetic to it. I criticize it a great deal, but I feel that the critics, while I will walk down the road with them a long way, they don't look closely enough at some of the possibilities that have emerged from this movement. Right now, we're in the midst of some really interesting studies into the placebo effect, something that we've known about for a long, long time, but that I think we are producing some really interesting new data in, and studies that are coming out of Harvard and UCLA and other medical schools. I think that the people in the positive thinking movement, first of all, they had a rough early idea of a genuine connection between our mood and our sense of physical well-being that I think has been borne out in part by placebo studies, by mind-body medicine, by the familiarity with which we talk about stress-related disease today, whether it be hypertension or ulcers or chronic back or neck or shoulder pain. There's a realization that stress and mood plays a genuine role in our lives. And I also think that within cognitive psychology, the recovery groups, support groups, the 12-step approach to addiction recovery. You have principles and ideas from the positive thinking movement. People very rarely refer back to that movement as an antecedent, but the positive thinkers, although they were using a religious language in the 19th century, they were really struggling with a very rough early conception of what later came to be known as the subconscious mind or the unconscious mind. And I think their efforts amounted to something.
I want to talk about what's been a bit of a centerpiece in the world of positive thinking, and that is this movie called The Secret, which
yes.
became kind of a runaway hit. It had roots, though, that went back far earlier. Can you tell us about that and where it came from?
Sure. One of the most ironic aspects of The Secret is that when it became popular in 2006, 2007, it directed people's attention to some of the old positive thinking classics. And one of the books that the movie repeatedly extolled and that became very popular was a book called The Science of Getting Rich by a man named Wallace D. Wattles, who had been a Methodist minister and a longtime exponent of what was known as the social gospel. What many of the people who rediscovered Wattles' books didn't realize is that he was a socialist through and through. He ran for Congress and for local offices in Indiana on the Socialist Party ticket of Eugene V. Debs. He was an absolute social progressive and radical who believed at the time that some of these avant-garde religious methods, like the metaphysics of the mind, could help smooth out imbalances in wealth. And if you read The Science of Getting Rich carefully and you kind of have a map of what you're looking for, there's unmistakable socialist and Marxist language in it. And when this book was republished in 2007, it went to the number one spot on the Business Week bestseller list, and it was a centerpiece of The Nation. Of The Secret. It is basically a metaphysical expression of some of the ideas that came out of the social gospel, which was a radical Christian movement that translated the ethics of Christ into a conception of an equitable society, a socially just society. And that was an ironic early part of the development of the prosperity gospel. The prosperity gospel today is associated with mega churches and business motivation, but a lot of the early exponents of it actually believed that metaphysics along with social protest could be a way of creating a more equitable society.
Well, that seems weird to me because a socialist perspective you'd think would be community-oriented, group-oriented,
right.
collective, where I think of The Secret as an individual. How am I going to make myself rich? I don't know The Secret,
that's right.
but that's the gist, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, back in the day, in the progressive era, there was an expression of socialism that was kind of more utopian. There was a novel, Looking Backward, by a man named Edward Bellamy, and he saw this world of mass luxury and plenty and leisure, and that was the vision that Wallace Wattles was coming out of. That vision by the 1930s and 40s disappeared from the positive thinking movement, so it translated more into what you do see in our time in The Secret, which is more of a radically individualist vision.
We're talking to Mitch Horowitz. His new book is One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. Do you believe positive thinking works? Have you seen an example of it in your own life or a time maybe that it didn't work for you? And do you think the self-help industry takes advantage of people more than it actually helps them? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can always post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking right now with Mitch Horowitz. He's vice president and editor-in-chief at Penguin Tarcher Imprint. And we're talking about his book, One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life.
And we'd like to hear your thoughts on positive thinking. Are you a believer or a skeptic? Do you have an example of a time when positive thinking helped you, maybe got you through a hard time, or where it didn't work for you? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Oh, and if you were around when The Power of Positive Thinking came out, did it change your life or people you knew? 800-642-1234 is the number, or send an email, talk@wpr.org. Well, Mitch, I want to get into the world of Oprah nowadays. She helped promote The Secret, which we were talking about a little bit there. How has Oprah affected how we think about positive thinking and inspirational messages these days?
Well, she brought many metaphysical books into people's living rooms, and in a certain sense, Oprah was almost someone would have become Oprah. You know, it was an inevitable phenomenon. Because
if Oprah didn't exist, we'd have to invent her.
Exactly. And we would have. I mean, really, every strain of self-help or therapeutic thought in this country intersects with the positive thinking idea, which is that our thoughts, in some measure or another, determine outcome. And Oprah was this enormously articulate person who was able to capture a therapeutic outlook that has really run throughout our country for a long, long time. When Ronald Reagan was first running for president, he would routinely say in his speeches, nothing is impossible. And Americans were able to connect with that because of generations of motivational psychology. Other presidents just didn't sound that way. Dwight Eisenhower didn't sound that way. Richard Nixon didn't sound that way. But after Reagan, every president had to sound that way. So when Obama was giving his State of the Union address in 2011, he uttered the line, this is a country where anything is possible. And it was a leaf directly out of Reagan. So we all talk that way to a greater or lesser extent. And those of us who think, oh, gee, that's just shallow and superficial, you'll catch yourself every now and then actually using that phraseology. It's just in the groundwater of our country.
What does the brain research have to say about all this? If we hear a message, you know, from Ronald Reagan, anything's impossible, nothing's impossible, are there certain areas of our brain that just light up and get happy?
Well, there has been some interesting brain research at UCLA recently that touches on all this. There's an emerging field called neuroplasticity, in which researchers have found through brain scans that the actual redirection of your thoughts through certain ritualistic patterns can result in a change in the neural pathways, the pathways in which neurons fire in your brain. So, for example, this has implications for treating people who suffer from obsessive-compulsive disorder. Researchers have found that if people can actively and sustainably redirect their thoughts away from certain ritualistic behaviors, eventually, in cases of OCD, that will result in redirected neural pathways in the brain. And this is a promising field. So, you know, we do have some evidence within a certain window of study that shows that our thoughts and our thought patterns do have some biologic implications for the brain.
We've got some callers who want to weigh in on this now. We'll go to Lee first in Barron County. Lee, hi.
Hi. When I first heard you talking and your guest talking, I was like, oh, I've been there. I've done that. I used to belong to a church years ago. This would have been in the 1980s, affiliated with the Unity School of Christianity, they're called.
Sure.
And they're very much part of this turn-of-the-century movement that you were talking about. My understanding is that they were basically an offshoot of Christian Science. And what I always called them, for people who didn't understand, was I would tell them it was Christian Science Light. You were allowed to go to the doctor. it served me well in some ways. What I really liked about it was that a critical mass of their ministers are women.
Mm-hmm.
About 40-45%, which is was astonishing to me, and that really appealed to me. So I was affiliated with the church for a number of years, but what ended up making me leave it was I was suffering from, at the time, I know this now, but I didn't really understand it then, from clinical depression. And the positive thinking, the as you think, you will become kind of theology had me in a funk, and it was making the depression worse, actually, that because I wasn't thinking the right thoughts, I wasn't able to heal myself, and as a result, I was staying miserable.
Lee, thanks so much. And is that a common criticism, Mitch, of positive thinking?
Yes, and that's a wonderful observation. And in fact, I start out the first chapter of my book quoting from a letter from a woman who sounds much like the caller, very deeply sensitive, intelligent person who attended a metaphysical positive thinking church. And she left disillusioned after several years because she was working as a coordinator for a group of women survivors of sexual abuse. And she said she could see both sides of it. She could see how a program of mental therapeutics, on one hand, could help a person, under the right circumstances, rebuild a sense of self. But on the other hand, could turn into this hectoring and sometimes almost victim-blaming dogma or approach. And she left. And my message to the people in the positive thinking movement, and I say this to them as a person who's inside their world, not outside their world, is that If you can't retain smart, sensitive people like that, this movement is not going to maintain a congregational structure. You know, I think the positive thinking movement has got to get away from this one overarching idea, which is featured in The Secret, that our thoughts are this kind of super law that we all live under. We live under many factors and forces, and the caller was pointing out she was experiencing clinical depression. She needed medical care. She needed medical attention. The positive thinking movement has got to accommodate itself to the complexity of people's lives.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the call, Lee. And let's move on to Monica joining us from Greenfield. Hi there.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I was not exposed to the positive thinking as a theology, so I couldn't say much about that. But I think it reminds me of my mother. We grew up Catholic, very devoted Catholic, but she has still a very positive way of looking at life. And she used to tell us when we were growing up, especially the girls, if you frown at your hair, you are for sure going to have a bad hair day. And her attitude was always one of, there are going to be problems in life. As I said, being a Catholic, we believe that God is in the driver's seat, but we still have the option of buckling up or not. And to take problems and be a part of the solution, not the problem. So your call reminds me of that. It's a thing, a lighter way of seeing it, not mm-hmm. as a theology or a religion.
So it sounds, Monica, like this is something you were okay growing up with it because it taught you that you could maybe have some choice, some volition about the way you thought about the world.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks so much for the call, Monica.
Yeah, I'm in great sympathy with what she said. You know, too often we hear these things and we think, oh, you know, don't tell me to have a nice day. It sounds so, you know, it sounds sometimes to people like it's immature or it's a sort of forced cheerfulness. But those ideas can go deeper and can represent more in a person's life than we sometimes understand. My mother-in-law is a devout Catholic, and she recently retired from a position as an associate dean at Harvard Medical School, a very accomplished person, and in many respects a very self-made person in the truest sense. She's absolutely dedicated to all kinds of positive thinking ideas and literature, and she has postcards and little business card-sized signs hanging up throughout her apartment that have all these positive thinking affirmations on them. And, you know, to the outsider, these things can sometimes seem like a forced display of cheerfulness. But for some people, they really do make a difference. They can flick a switch at certain sensitive moments that help an individual get through a stress or get through a difficulty of the day.
Mitch, looking toward the future, we've seen a lot of commentary over the years that we're getting more cynical. We're maybe more negative than we used to be. Do you see cynicism crowding out positive thinking in the United States?
I do, actually. The kind of discourse that goes on online and in texts and social postings, tweets and such, tends to be very, very coarse, and it's just endemic to our society. I think, actually, we are going through a really deep and substantial coarsening of our communication, and we as individuals are all going to have to take a look at that because it's going to reach a point of irreversibility where rudeness and cynicism and sarcasm just becomes quite normal. And it's very different from the kind of correspondence that people conducted, say, 30, 40 years ago. One of the reasons, among many, that the positive thinking movement grew to popularity in the early 19th century is that the economy was changing from an agricultural to an industrial and corporate base. People were flowing into jobs in large offices and professional workplaces for the very first time. They didn't always know how to act, what proper decorum was, what proper communication was. To an extent, there are positive thinking books that people sometimes make fun of today, like Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People, but those books answered a certain need. They helped people understand what was expected of them in terms of decorum in professional atmospheres. We are going to have to relearn those lessons in the digital age because the degree, I believe, of cynicism and coarseness over digital communication is really becoming suffocating.
Mitch, thank you so much. We appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
That was Mitch Horowitz, Vice President and Editor-in-Chief at Penguin's Tarcher imprint. He's the author of One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life.
Coming up after the news, we'll be back with a look at a U.S. federal appeals court ruling on net neutrality. We'll find out what that means to us. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.